This is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping the local area. Inside Douglas County is presented by Concrete Builder Supply. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon. Thanks for being here. We cover lots of different things around the Umpqua Valley. Periodically, we like to check out the Umpqua Valley wine scene, and that often is best done on a Friday after a long week of maybe more serious news stories. But a guy who's known for being very serious about wine, Dyson DeBarra of Hillcrest Vineyards, and Paul O'Brien, and even more. In, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's good to see you, Kyle.
Yeah. And so what types of things do you have going on this summer with your properties?
What we're doing here locally, there's always something going on. In many parts of the world, people farm grapes and sell the fruit. In some places, people will make wine and not even market the wine. They'll take fruit from these growers, make it into wine, and then sell it to somebody called a négociant that will blend it and bottle it. And a lot of what you see in the grocery stores are what we say within the industry, négociant wines. If you're growing grapes, making wine, you know, pushing the envelope a little bit, doing some kind of new things and stuff, it's constant. It's like a newborn baby, but it never grows up. it's constant. So we're doing a lot of farming now. We're getting ready to back off of that some. So we're getting, and actually I was out walking vineyards this morning looking for the very first signs of this, but one of the most important points of the season is veraison, and consumers are familiar with this, even if you're not familiar with wine. And that would be like a tomato, where most fruits and that cherries, they're green at the very beginning of the season. As they get into what we say the harvest window, that they're kind of closing in on it, you begin to see it swell and change color, and the oldest fruits in the world are all yellow or red, and wine grapes are yellow and red, depending on what you're picking in that. And so we're looking for that first sign, and that gives us a little bit of an idea of like how spread across what kind of window is the fruit on a plant, because not all berries ripen on a plant exactly the same time. So what kind of range we have, which, you know, there's some farming things that we can do to kind of tighten that up a little bit, tighter being better there. And it also helps us project harvest. So Pinot Noir, of the dominant varieties here, Pinot Noir is the early variety. So that's really kind of the benchmarks. We're out there looking for veraison change in color. And so far we haven't seen any, but from the point that we get about half the vineyard colored up, and a lot of you that go out to wineries and that, you'll drive up a driveway or near a vineyard and you'll see kind of, you know, some red berries, some kind of pinky ones and green and that. When that's about 50% colored up, that cluster, we know we're roughly about 45 days out.
Wow. And of course, it varies by the varietal, right?
It totally varies by variety. As a general rule, so like with tomatoes, you have early season varieties, mid season, late season. You have the same thing with grapes. And so there are grape varieties that wake up really early that are prone to spring frost. Typically, those are the first ones you start your harvest with, and then vice versa, the stuff that pushes, it begins to grow. It emerges from dormancy maybe a month later. Around here, that's, you know, would be like Cabernet Sauvignon. I grow a variety called Teraldego, Italian varietal, Malbec. That stuff tends to be towards the back end of that window. And so then there are varieties. There's a variety, Nebbiolo, that we play with at different places a little bit. And Nebbiolo is the earliest thing to pop and the last thing to ripen, which is very, very unusual. But yeah, it's very varietal dependent. And there are many varieties. I think the last number I saw in Umpqua, and I've added two to that since that number, but that's about 80. But there's somewhere between 4,000 and 8,000 grape varieties in the world.
Wow. And the Umpqua Valley, with the diversity of the land, you've got all these different possibilities where certain things grow really well in one area, you focus on other things in other parts of the valley.
Completely, and not even in a part of the valley, but on a hillside. I mean, the difference between elevation exposure is everything. I mean, you can have, it's actually one of the beautiful, beautiful complexing things about Umpqua Valley is also one of the great challenges, and that's that it takes a long time to figure out your little spot. You might have a neighbor that's like at the bottom of a hill facing east, and they grow nice Pinot Noir, and you stick Pinot right above it, slightly warmer, maybe tastes more like port or Cabernet Sauvignon Pinot. And so the complexity that we have here, with more soil types than any wine region in the world, over 150 soil types, there are very few fine wine areas in the world. I always say you want to drink stuff off of hillsides. The great vineyards of the world generally are off of hillsides, and that we have thin soils, you get small crops, you get super intense flavors, you get unique personalities and that, but you want to own the flat stuff. The flat stuff is good business. That's the tomato land. You grow high crop in that. And that's typically the cheap wines in the world. And so we play with a little bit of all of that, but it's a question of really trying to figure out, you know, what we're going to get, where we're going to get it, varietals, and anyway.
Well, and different properties, you know, I've talked to Stephen Russell over the years and Earl Jones at different points. They've talked about their properties, and, you know, for instance, they might have something on a hillside doing much better than if they would put it on the flatland that is just a few hundred feet away.
Exactly. I mean, it can be, so water is a big retention factor in this, that on hillsides, of course, you have shallow soils, which gives you less water retention, gives you smaller plants, smaller cluster, smaller berry, more intense flavor, especially for reds. But you get into situations that you have hillside vineyards with springs. There's a lot of that on the east side of the Umpqua here in the valley. So it's kind of, it's really getting to know a piece of property, and there's nothing like planting a grape on it because you can look at it. A vine will tell you if you know how to read a vine. That's something that in the modern world, we're not very good at. We like to teach the answers out of a book, but the wisdom of the old world where somebody didn't go to school for winemaking many times, but it's 20 generations on a site, that there's incredible. And it's the same thing with gardening. You know, an old person interested in gardening that's been gardening the backyard for 50 years, I mean, what they know, you could never get the greatest landscape crew in the world to understand. And so fine wine grape growing is exactly that. I worked on a project when I was at Mondavi with NASA that we use Landsat satellites and all of our equipment, tractors, everything hooked up to this stuff, but we could tell you within 1 square meter the density of chlorophyll, and that told us something about the vigor. So when I was talking about how thin soils are, how vigorous the plants are, as a general rule, high vigor plants produce a lot of fruit but not interesting wine in its low to moderate vigor sites. So like I farm, everything I do is dry farmed hillside. I farm out at about 1.5-2 tons an acre. The average yield in Umpqua is about 4.5 tons an acre. You go into Napa Valley, you're pushing 7 or 8 tons an acre. You go into Lodi, a brand new top vineyard's about 26 tons an acre. Those are typically geared towards very different products.
Wow. So much science in this, and I don't think the average person realizes that.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of science, but there's also a lot of industry. And I don't like to use the word industry so much around wine, but the thing is that most people buy wheat that have a bakery and they make bread and sell bread. We do agriculture. We do production. We do marketing. Those are usually very, very different hats. And especially when you get into small wineries, you really have to do all three, and you have to be very good at hopefully at least a couple of them in that. But being poor, I mean, I in my years, you know, I'm over 40 years now in the wine business, different places in the world.
So you started when you were like 3.
Yeah. Good Mormon kid. Yeah. I was 16. Actually, I took my first wine course at 18 at a college, and it was a wine tasting course. And this goes back to the early 80s when, you know, nobody expected a young 18-year-old to kind of crash a wine tasting course. Wine was not cool in 82. You know, it was something kind of for the old kind of librarian folk. But, yeah. Anyway.
Wow. So this summer, have you been just focused on your properties here, or are you out elsewhere in the world checking things out?
Other places in the world. I've had a couple trips to Spain. I've got 2 projects I'm working on in Spain, and I'm trying to put something together in Italy that's still not kind of a done deal. But we've spent, I think, about 3 weeks in Spain so far, and I'm probably in the very back end of the year have one more trip planned. But, you know, our backgrounds are worked mostly in Napa Valley and that, but I've worked other parts of California, and I've worked in Europe and Asia and South America in the wine business. So I have a great curiosity. And wine, it's like food. Once you kind of open that door beyond just kind of, you know, maintaining life or whatever, it's just such a huge world. It's so interesting to look at what's the other side of the fence. And we've been very lucky, not just my wife and I, but our children have worked different parts of the world. I've got my daughter's worked in Barolo in Piemonte, northern Italy. She's worked in Friuli, northeastern Italy. She's worked in the Patagonia. She's worked in Germany in the Mosel Valley and stuff. And so it's really amazing because wine, we joke that wine's the second oldest profession in the world. And it's only been in just very, very recent times you could go around the world and kind of understand what somebody's doing in a little pocket of the world and try to bring those ideas back or think how you do things differently in that. And that's one of the things that allows us to scale up so much. We have such powerful nature here to make great wine, but we've really never had until just here in the last couple decades kind of a real push to try to produce world-class fine wines because who are you going to sell that stuff to? So we made wine, but we didn't like really try to pursue, with rare exception, great stuff. But today we take and we leverage that, but we're still a long ways away from understanding our vineyards the way the great places that been doing it for 2 millennia, understand, but we're getting there.
All right, back with more in a moment. Dyson Navarre from Hillcrest Vineyards and Paul O'Brien. When we come back, the interview podcast after 1 at 541radio.com, 1245 News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. Lakeside, Douglas County, 1248. Lars Larson coming up at 1 o'clock, Umpqua Valley Live this afternoon at 4. We'll be talking to a couple of members of I Draw Slow. They'll be at the Half Shell on Tuesday, and we'll get a little conversation in with them this afternoon as they're on tour. Brian Trinkle of Greater Douglas United Way talks about their upcoming campaign on Mondays inside Douglas County. Dyson DeBarra of Hillcrest Vineyard in here. A wine in the Umpqua program. I got one question in and we had half the interview. That's amazing. We just start talking about wine and it's pretty fascinating. Now, in the summertime, obviously very busy, and of course other things happening around the Umpqua Valley. Everybody's got things tied to wine.
They do, and there's many different takes on it. There are more and more wineries, and this is typically a sign as things grow too. People look some way to kind of brand themselves. You see more and more people serving pizzas and different kinds of drinks and different things. We are purely a winery. We've spent our entire life other parts of the world working wine. You walk into our taste room, I don't sell t-shirts, wine openers, you know, anything. We sell wine and that's what we do. But it has gotten a lot better. My wife and I, you know, we've been doing it now here. It's hard to imagine in the Valley for a little over 20 years, but we have two of our kids, Hannah and Tucker, that have joined us. And so they've taken over some farming responsibilities, helping with winemaking, both of them on the inside, as well as we have like a special event this year. We put together our first many places in the world you can go in and you can have like a very high-end experience that's very kind of technical about wine. And so we've started like a winemaker tour series that we ran this summer with a lot of success. Everyone was sold out, but where we really get into the nitty-gritty, we really define what Umpqua is. We talk about it in relation to other parts of the world. We taste our wines versus wines of similar varietals, maybe or character in Europe, and that to give people contrast. We do a glass seminar as part of this, kind of a little mini seminar about how important glasses are to affecting the way that you actually taste the wine. And it's you know, for those of you that aren't familiar with that, it's something even to get online and take a look at. I've got a little YouTube video at Hillcrest Vineyard on YouTube, but you know, I've done seminars for like an hour and a half on wine glasses, but I mean it is all the difference in the world. And even if you just drink like $10 wines, it actually improves $10 wines more than a $500 wine. It's so important.
So you're not recommending the red Solo cup then, are you?
Believe me, I've drank a lot of wine out of the bottle. It depends on where you are, what you have. But I've not seen that one yet. But we talk about like the importance of lead crystal versus glass is a huge thing. But you know, it's at different stages. In the beginning, oftentimes people just like, you know, they like the taste of a wine, and then you start getting into like what's the basic winemaking, and then you get into the nature, which is really the interesting part of different places in the world. Wineries have very little to do with fine wine. It really has to do with the nature. And so it's like ingredients that, you know, we talk about like San Francisco sourdough. I mean, everybody in the world makes sourdough, but San Francisco has a fingerprint. The most expensive wines in the world, there are places in the world land sells for $16 million an acre to grow Chardonnay because that bottle of wine's $4,000, $7,000 a bottle. And there's a flavor in that site you don't get anywhere else in the world that's prized.
Wow. You know, in the summertime, a lot of people move more to white wines with, you know, all the outdoor events, and it's warmer, and a lot of times I mean, people like me don't tend to drink white wines outside of the summer. So just how cold should they be, or does it depend on the varietal?
It depends on the varietal. Number one, drink whatever temperature you like. I like to drink champagne really cold, colder than's recommended. If I'm paying a lot of money for champagne, I'm drinking it the way I like it, and I suggest you do that with everything, no matter what it costs. But there are two categories of white wine, really. There are aromatic whites, and those would be things like Muscat, Gewurztraminer, that are very perfumed. And then there are things like Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc. The chemicals that give them their flavor are very different. So like most red wines, not all red wines, but most red wines are like Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, that what gives them their aromatics, those compounds are called esters. And at really cold temperatures, basically below 50 degrees, it's trapped and you can't smell it. And humans smell way more than we taste. We only taste four things in nature, three things in wine, but we smell over 10,000. So it's really the aromatics of a wine that we like the most. So it's really critical for like Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, these kind of mainstream whites, to serve those right above 50 degrees where it's cool and fresh, but it's not so much that it's like pinching your nose and drinking it, that you get no aromatics up in your olfactory senses. When you look at like Muscat, Riesling, Gewurztraminer, those are called terpenes, and terpenes below 50 degrees are still really volatile to where you could put it in your mouth and taste it. And so those you can serve, you know, just everything but frozen kind of thing and still get most of the flavor, but it's personal. When it comes to red, so, most countries in the world that drink a lot of wine drink a majority of red, and then they do white and rosé seasonally, or if you're at the coast
opposed to having shellfish in that. There's a trend a little bit in America, I think I've observed, we don't talk about it too much, but people beginning to drink more white than red. White's much easier on your system, and without going into chemistry, it's the kind of thing, like, I drink probably 70% white wine today, because I can have, like, a couple glasses in the evening. I wake up the next day, and it's like I had iced tea. If I have, like, a real modern, you know, higher alcohol red, which a lot of, you know, things, that's one of the reasons I came to Umpqua, is you can actually make red wines at, like, you know, 12.8, 13.5% alcohol. There's a logarithmic difference between, like, 13.5 and 14.5, 15%. If I have two glasses of that, I wake up in the morning and I think about it for a second. Oh, yeah, I had that wine. I remember. Yeah. And so there are also reds that are very beautiful chilled. If you don't have oak and you don't have tannin on a red, there are a lot of areas of the world, very classic winemaking areas, that that's what the winemakers drink. And it might not be the kind of thing they're known for, but it's what they consume. So you go to Piemonte, they're known for Nebbiolo, which makes the great wines Barolo, Barbaresco, but they're all drinking Barbera. And I make a Barbera, and Barbera, you can put a chill on it and have it with barbecue, and it's just, it's so fantastic. You don't have to drink at room temperature or, let's say, 58, 60 degrees, whatever. There's also a red, we're getting ready to release our first Gamay, and the wines of Beaujolais are the same thing. You can put tannin to it, either extracting the fruit a little bit more, add tannin, which a lot of people do, and that, or you can make something that's just beautiful, silky fruit with a lot of malic acid, which is a style that we do. That, I mean, you can put your elbows up on the table, put a chill on it, and then those wines are beautiful sitting out on the patio having a glass, but they're also beautiful at the table with food.
Now, you added some land to your properties a couple years ago. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so we have three different properties now. We have the Hillcrest out there west of the Melrose store, about 4 miles, and that's kind of the homestead, you'd say. The old Misty Oaks property, Paso Colina, we have that mostly grafted over to other varietals. We kept a couple of those varieties, but we've got a lot of Italian out there. And then we've made a big push into Cab Franc and Malbec. We believe those are two of the real signature grapes. Richard Summers, the father of Oregon wine, that started Hillcrest and came up and planted 35 varieties day one and played with all those. I always asked him, hey, if you had to plant those again, minus Pinot Noir and Riesling, which were super successful for him, what would you plant? And he always said, Malbec, Malbec, Malbec. We're beginning to see ourselves get a lot of press in that. I just had a wine presented to a group of international wine writers, to over 180 wine writers, and the wine that was chosen was 6 wines from the state of Oregon, and there's one wine chosen from Umpqua, and it was our Malbec in that. So that property is a little bit warmer, higher elevation. It's almost like an amphitheater that faces south. And then we have a property right near River Forks and that we acquired. At some point, we'll open up a separate tasting room and do kind of this. Our daughter went to winemaking school in northeastern Italy, and we've got some Italian varietals, a couple places and that. But and I'm sure many people out there know La Pig. We do the Barbera, but I do Terroir de Go. I've planted a couple of other varietals that were the first ones in Oregon to do. Very rare varieties anywhere in America kind of thing. But Italian varietals that we really love in our travels over to Europe. And we spent last summer, we spent a little bit of time in one of those regions and really kind of absorbed viticulture and winemaking to try to understand what they understand or what their perception is, so we could kind of leverage that a little bit here. Yeah, we're always playing with something. You know, it's one of the amazing things about wine is it's endless. I mentioned the, you know, agriculture, production, marketing. It's also, you get into varieties. I mean, to really understand a variety, it takes probably 15 to 25 years to understand what kind of conditions it wants to be grown in, what type of rootstock. And this is if you're really applying yourself. How to prune it, when to pick it, winemaking techniques. And, you know, as a drive-by or for a lot of people beginning in the business, you kind of apply basic things. But once again, that ability to think and the wisdom of the old world and those that have done it a long time, oftentimes you learn a lot more, like many things, leaning over the fence and talking to somebody that's done it than reading a book or going to school.
All right. If people want to find out more about what you have going on, what's your website for Hillcrest?
Yeah, hillcrestvineyard.com. And we have a taste room open every day of the year, minus the big four holidays. And we'd love to show people our wares.
All right, Dyson DeBar at Hillcrest Vineyards, Paul O'Brien, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
1257 News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.